The concept of advertising is as old as business itself. This is intuitive, of course, since you can't make money selling a product or service unless other people know you're selling it. However, advertising has taken many forms throughout human civilization. Ancient Egyptians used papyrus to create signs, many civilizations relied on wall paintings to convey messages, and oral advertising was common across most cultures. Fast forward to the Middle Ages, and tradespeople began using images to represent their businesses. Think of an anvil for a blacksmith, or a shoe for a cobbler. When farmers brought their wares to market, they would hire town criers to spread the word. All of these ancient forms of advertising are still around in some form today, but innovations in technology have produced many other types of ads over the years. Brands would become household names thanks to print ads in newspapers and eventually spoken word ads on the radio, which were often creative and involved music and slogans. Take this one, for example, which begins one way and takes an unexpected turn.
Is the sweetheart you married the husband you expected him to be? Has the war created new problems for you in your marriage? To answer these and other personal problems brought in by your friends and neighbors, Arid presents John J. Anthony, founder of the famed Marital Relations Institute, in a brand new program of daily sessions of kindly and helpful advice. Just as Mr. Anthony, by examples in this studio, is helping thousands of men and women solve their personal problems, Arid, too, is helping thousands to solve the important personal problem of underarm perspiration. Arid helps you avoid perspiration damage to clothes and safeguards friendships. Use Arid every day. It helps stop perspiration safely, and at the same time, Arid is a most effective deodorant.
I suppose if I ever have trouble writing transitions for this show, I should look to those writers for help. Anyhow, we all know what happened next. Television changed the nature of advertising yet again. Famous slogans, jingles, and mascots became even more popular. Every new television program offered companies new avenues to advertise their products. Print ads were also popular, given the large circulation of magazines throughout the 20th century. But all of a sudden, in the early 1990s, the rise of the World Wide Web created a brand new medium for advertising. We know this. You can hardly go two clicks after opening a browser window before seeing some form of advertising. These may be audio, video, links, text, or images. It's as if all of the historic forms of advertising have now come together in one place. The web was now a place of booming business, despite concerns in the mid-1990s about how or if mass adoption of the internet would occur. I mean, people did have to put up with this every time they connected. Nevertheless, the sound of a 56K modem going online was magic for adults and children alike. Oh, and it still is for many rural communities in the United States, so go encourage your local governments to expand broadband access. Anyway, during the dot-com boom, websites sprang to life about almost any topic imaginable. Advertising was right at the center of all of this, albeit not in the way you might imagine. Internet startups poured millions of dollars into traditional advertising to drive traffic to their sites. Just from 1998 to 2000, websites spent over $10 billion in today's dollars on TV ad spots and other forms of traditional advertising. But following the burst of the dot-com bubble, advertising went through a reorganization. TV ads maintained their momentum, but as more and more people gained access to the web, a shift away from magazines and newspapers occurred. Online ads began to take off. But here's the key shift. Publishers and TV network owners could only surmise so much about their audiences. They might have known their customers' ages and addresses, and to some extent their viewing habits, thanks to Nielsen ratings. But what if they could know more, or perhaps much more? Internet advertising offered a solution, one that would create an industry unlike anything before.
We do have a clause within our terms of service.
I think average users read the terms of service and the updates that are very frequently sent to us.
You know, we are in a societal debate, as we should be, about information practices.
We want people to be able to both review terms of service agreements and privacy policies, and we want them to discuss what they mean, so it creates this type of feedback loop.
When we talk about privacy, is it possible in the 21st century?
You said you agreed when you signed up, so now what? I'm Ethan Smith, and as we'll find out, terms and conditions apply. 1997, internet advertising revenue was just over $1 billion in today's dollars. Over the past 20 years, that number has surged astronomically, with total revenue topping $100 billion in 2018. Advertising is the very lifeblood of the online ecosystem. Think about it. Unless you're using an ad blocking extension in your desktop browser, it's hard to find a website that doesn't have some sort of banner ad, video ad, or worst of all, one of those ads that literally blocks you from seeing the content you're reading until you dismiss it. This is even more common on mobile phones. But of course, these methods of web advertising had to start somewhere.
I've actually been working on the web since shortly after inception. I started working on a company called Tripod in late 1994. And that's the company that I was working at when we were working on early internet advertising models.
The voice you just heard is Ethan Zuckerman. When the World Wide Web began gaining popularity in the early 1990s, Ethan got involved in building a website called Tripod.
Tripod was a business started up by classmates of mine at Williams College. And the idea behind it was going to be a magazine of sorts. It was basically going to be, here's what you need to know as a recent college grad. Let's help you find your job. Let's help you find your apartment. Maybe you should make some investments. You should think about saving money, things along those lines. It turned out that it was not a great space for us to be in, for the simple reason that there were already people creating enormous amounts of similar content. And one of the things that we really hadn't understood was that it just wasn't going to be that hard for traditional publishers to move themselves onto the web. So what ended up happening was we quickly figured out that people were much less interested in reading our content than they were in publishing their own content.
Tripod became a website that allowed its users to create their own space online, similar to GeoCities or eventually MySpace, if you recall either of those. Thousands of new users began pouring onto the platform, so naturally in 1994, Ethan and the Tripod development team began looking for ways to monetize across all of these users' web pages that didn't involve charging a subscription fee. That's when Ethan pioneered one of the web's most infamous forms of advertising.
We had to find some model that was going to make it possible for us to make money off of user content. And what's tricky about it is that because you don't have control over what a user is putting on their homepage, a lot of advertisers don't necessarily want to be on the page. We had some pretty strong restrictions about what kind of page you could have on Tripod, but we didn't have the ability to review all of those pages. So we would often end up in situations where there would be a page with pornography or pirated software or something along those things, and advertisers really did not want to be on those pages. So unfortunately, I ended up pioneering the pop-up ad as a way of distancing ads from the user content. So the whole idea was you would load up a user's web page, you would get to see what you wanted to see on her page, and then another window would open up with an ad in it. And initially, of course, it wasn't just an ad, it was also some Tripod branding, it was some navigation features. But very quickly, our competitor, GeoCities, picked it up and they stripped it down to basically just GeoCities branding and an ad. And, you know, at that point, then we had the pop-up ad.
Pop-up ads dominated websites for many years, and they got so bad that often so many pop-ups would load in that users would abandon browsing the site altogether. Keep in mind that browser tabs were not a thing in the 1990s, so every time a pop-up ad occurred, it opened a new browser window. And just a few of these could quickly slow down the average computer, so it makes sense that people became frustrated, especially since many ads featured fake close buttons that just linked to another ad. By the late 1990s, browsers Opera and Mozilla Firefox came with a pre-installed pop-up blocker. And finally, in 2004, Microsoft joined in by including one in its Internet Explorer browser. All major browsers today block these ads by default, so it's clear we've seen a shift towards other types of ads since the mid-2000s. I mentioned earlier that online ad revenue increased 100-fold between 1997 and 2018. So that means online advertising must be extremely effective, right? Well, as it turns out, this may not be true. But before we discuss the effectiveness of online ads, I want to take a moment to connect this back to the title of our series. It is, after all, a podcast about terms and conditions. Well, one of the key reasons large and cumbersome terms and conditions agreements even exist is so companies can communicate to you how they are collecting your data and what they are going to use it for. So why is it that online companies and websites desire to know so much about you? It's important to reflect on the purpose of advertising in general here. If your business has a product, you want to connect with potential buyers. And while there are some products that have a general appeal to all of humanity, most of the time that's not the case. Businesses want to advertise to people who they feel are more likely to purchase their products, their target audience. I'm reminded of a great example of this from my childhood. When I would spend time at my grandmother's house, at 11 o'clock sharp, we'd turn on the television to watch The Price is Right, which, for those of you unfamiliar, is a daytime TV game show in the United States where contestants play pricing-based games in order to win prizes. As a kid, my brother and I would always note that the ads during commercial breaks were almost all for prescription drugs, medication insurance, life insurance, and other in-home services. Now, as children, we couldn't have cared less about any of these things. But there came a certain age where I realized those ads weren't targeting me. They were targeting my grandmother. Senior citizens are, in fact, more likely to purchase medications, life insurance, and the like. So you don't have to dive too deep into viewer data and ratings to surmise that the most likely demographic to be watching daytime television during the week is, well, senior citizens. Hence, all of the ads which were targeting their specific age group. I mentioned Nielsen ratings earlier, and for television advertisements, these ratings have traditionally been very valuable to networks and their potential advertisers, since it can tell them things about the general age group of the people watching. However, there are still limitations when you only know information about someone's age group. While TV networks can also narrow down targeted advertisements by geography, it's more difficult to get any more specific. And this is seemingly the same for print publications like newspapers and magazines. But with the inception of the web, things began to change. What if you could convince an advertiser that you could always show her ads to the targeted audience? When you visit a web page, certain details about you are recorded with that web page. The biggest one is your IP address, which is a unique identifier assigned to your computer when you connect to the internet, and it contains information about your geographic location. The website also sees the operating system and browser you're using to visit the page. If you think about it, location data have typically been known by print media companies as well. You have to give a newspaper company or magazine publisher your address if you want to receive their publication, after all. So let's take a moment to examine the history of online advertising as it relates to print media, because that may help us understand how media companies arrived at the current levels of data collection that even require these large terms and conditions agreements. When the web began to grow into the late 1990s and early 2000s, and more people began browsing websites online, suddenly there was a demand for online news. Early internet pioneers like Yahoo jumped at this opportunity and made a decision that still has massive implications on the way we consume media. They began offering their news stories for free.
But what publishers, I think, failed to realize is how to capitalize on their content.
That's Phyllis Weber. She's currently the director of advertising at my local newspaper, the Roanoke Times, and she's had a successful career in the newspaper business, working in advertising at the San Jose Mercury News, the San Francisco Chronicle, and most recently, the Charlotte Observer. The publishers she's talking about here aren't online publishers, but rather the large newspaper publishers that existed during the rise of the web. The problem of free news online wasn't going away.
Yahoo was putting it out for free. You didn't have to put, you know, a lot of big platforms, Sports Illustrated, ESPN. You could go to these other big platforms and get all this content for free. So publishers really struggled. And I remember Tony Ritter coming to the San Jose Mercury News, and he was one of the formidable owners of Knight Ritter.
I'll note here that while Phyllis was working for the San Jose Mercury News, it was owned by Knight Ritter, which owned 31 other newspapers across the U.S., making it one of the largest newspaper publishers at the time.
And Tony said, you know, it's the conundrum is, how do you charge a consumer for our content when they can get it for free all the time?
This presented a problem for the newspaper industry, which had enjoyed robust readership and dominated the print advertising in most markets. And it makes sense. People suddenly had free access to information and resources they had grown accustomed to assigning monetary value to.
I think what we didn't realize at the time, or we didn't value at the time, was that regardless of where the story lands, the origin of that story starts with a reporter and a writer. And that was valuable, right? But there was this kind of building fear that, oh my gosh, if we start charging too much, then we'll lose to the competition, we'll lose to broadcast, we'll lose to... And so it went on for probably 5 years with publishers really grappling with, how do we charge for this content? How do we monetize this content?
Initially, large publishers formed an alliance to cement their online presence in the form of classified ads through websites such as Cars.com, Apartments.com, and Realtor.com. These websites featured services that users could pay for, so there was still a direct path to revenue. However, once newspapers began posting all of their articles online, they had to look elsewhere. And here's where things get interesting. Everything I've discussed so far might have you thinking that targeted advertising is an idea that couldn't exist without the internet. But this is actually only partially true.
We've connected with research and conducted research for decades with our subscribers. We haven't done it through an email database or through a Survey Monkey in that capacity, but we've certainly mailed surveys, and we've collected, and we've made, you know, we've had telemarketing agencies conduct the research for us. So we've known in Roanoke, for example, how many families have school-aged children, right? How many families are 55 plus? How many families have millennials living in their home? So we've known that data for years because we've used research well.
That's Phyllis Weber again, this time with the revelation that newspapers have been performing research on their customers to woo advertisers for years. So the concept isn't actually new. However, the method definitely has changed. It's one thing for the newspaper to periodically send out a paper survey to its subscribers. They can choose to fill it out and provide the information freely to the company, or they could toss it in the recycling bin. But somewhere amid the rise of online ads and marketing, even traditional print publications would need to change their methods to stay relevant. More on that right after this. Welcome back. Sometime after mailed paper surveys and telemarketer calls, online tracking tools were invented. I could probably do an entire episode just on the technologies used to collect online data. But for now, let's focus on just two: cookies and tracking pixels. These are some of the most useful tracking tools available to online marketers today. And here's a brief overview of how they work. Every website you visit is built primarily with three coding languages. The first is called Hypertext Markup Language. You may have heard of it as HTML. And it provides the backbone of the page. It defines where things appear. The second is cascading style sheets, or CSS, and that defines what things look like, so colors or fonts, etc. Finally, you have JavaScript, which is for more advanced site features. If you aren't familiar with these, just right-click on any page you have open in a browser and select View Page Source. You will immediately see the code that results in the website you're viewing. Think of your web browser, like Firefox, Chrome, or Brave, as a translator. It reads the code, processes it, and displays the readable page for you. Cookies are part of this process that were designed to make repeat visits to the same website go more smoothly. For example, on a typical website that uses cookies, small amounts of information about you, like your IP address, your computer operating system, and your internet browser, are collected and stored in the cookie. The cookie is then stored on your computer. And if you were to close your browser and then visit the same web page the next day, the cookie would let the website know that you are a repeat visitor. Some common applications of cookies are online shopping carts. The cookie can store information about the items you've added so that they are still in the cart if you navigate away. Cookies can also be useful if you're filling out a form online and your connection is interrupted. Simply reload the page and the cookie recalls where you were, so the information you entered isn't completely lost. Cookies can be a very helpful tool for you as a user. However, when abused, they can also be used to track single users across multiple websites. This is the reason when you are searching for a new pair of shoes on a shopping website, and then you leave to play a game of words with friends, you'll see an ad appear for those shoes you had just been looking at. Your device's cookies had stored information that told both the shoe website and the ad network within Words with Friends that you were the same user. So the ad provider took it from there. Many browsers now block these so-called tracking cookies by default, and many websites have alerts or banners that give notice of their use of cookies. So if you don't want any more shoe ads to appear when you're trying to score that triple word, try exploring the settings in your browser or on your mobile phone. Of course, with cookies on the decline, advertisers had to come up with another way to observe and track user behavior. And this is where a more complicated form of tracking comes in. They're called tracking pixels. A tracking pixel is simply an invisible image on a web page. They load in just like regular images, except that when your browser reads and processes the code for these pixels, a message is sent to whomever coded that tracking pixel. Think of it as an activity log. Therefore, the entity that placed the tracking pixel now knows when you've accessed a specific page. And not just that, they know when you've accessed a specific spot on the page. Each pixel can be mapped. Here's an example. That same shoe website you were on earlier that sent you the ad in your game. They weren't just using cookies, they had tracking pixels as well. So they not only know that you looked at a specific type of shoes, they know where you navigated on each page, as well as how much time you spent looking at the shoe because there were tracking pixels on every part of the website. Now they can determine whether you were just glancing at the shoes, or perhaps you were getting serious about them because you spent a bit of extra time on the page, or perhaps almost clicked the buy button. Now the ads for the shoes are appearing on your Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram feeds. You can't get away from them. Tracking pixels are more useful for advertisers because they aren't as easily blocked, and are arguably more effective since they may provide more information about a user. Needless to say, cookies and tracking pixels on web pages are far more effective at gaining information about users than an optional telephone survey or mailer from your local newspaper. And now, after all that, we've looped back to the newspaper. In contrast to methods used in the past to gain information about print subscribers, here's how Phyllis Weber described the modern methods that the newspaper uses in its online platform.
When people come to your website, by virtue of tracking pixels, you know where they're coming from. You know how many times they're coming from. You know if a guy is coming to your website through social media and he is a Panther, he loves the Panthers. You know, if he goes to the sports section and he clicks on a story, that the pop-ups you talked about earlier, you can serve him a pop-up and ask him survey questions. Hey, it looks like you enjoy the Carolina Panthers and reading about them. Would you like to sign up for our Carolina Panthers newsletter and get breaking news before the public gets it? So there are so many sexy, sophisticated ways that data collectors are collecting that data now, that you can micro-target down to sub-sub-sub-zip to any demographic that you want, any lifestyle habit that you need to collect. There's a way to get at it.
We can all agree that suggesting a useful newsletter about your favorite sports team is probably the best possible use of tracking pixels online, especially when signing up for the newsletter is optional and it comes from a trusted source like your local newspaper. However, the vast ad networks across the web began collecting and using these types of data long before the local newspapers had even considered it.
Yeah, we relate to the party, and we're getting a lot better at it. But it definitely was a big eye opener. And here's the oddity of it: a lot of newspapers were collecting this data. Mm-hmm. They were already collecting the data, but we didn't have the prowess within our organizations to know how to market to these consumers, right? And again, we've gotten a lot better at it. We serve multiple newsletters here from the Roanoke Times multiple times a day to different demographics, right? Whether it's a ladies' boutique niche or whether it's the sports guy or the golfer, we've gotten a lot more sophisticated, but we still have a ways to go, because when you look at what Facebook is doing, when you look at what's happening with social media, you know, it's so creepy that retargeting has just taken over social media, but that's what's happened.
She's right. It's the norm now. So it was only natural for print publications to catch up and utilize these same data collection techniques. And as they caught up, so did their privacy policies and terms and conditions. The Roanoke Times is owned by BH Media Group, which currently owns and operates 30 daily newspapers across the United States. If the BH sounds familiar, think Berkshire Hathaway, and you'll realize Warren Buffett might own your local newspaper. Anyhow, if you scroll to the bottom of Roanoke.com, you'll see the links to terms and conditions as well as a privacy policy. The privacy policy, which is one developed by BH Media, specifically describes the types of data collection that Phyllis mentioned a few moments ago. It mentions that the website collects data on you, that it may ask you to voluntarily offer information about yourself occasionally, and that it will make use of cookies. It goes on to state that the information collected will be used for internal research, such as how and where to make improvements on the website, to customize a user's experience when using the website, and of course, to tailor advertising efforts. It goes on to say that, quote, "In order to continue providing services free of charge, the website sells advertising. Advertisers prefer to target their communication toward audiences who are most likely to be interested in their products," end quote. This is important to remember in the context of this show. The Roanoke Times' website is available freely. There's no paywall, so they must rely on advertising to create revenue. By using the website, you are agreeing to the collection of your data in exchange for free access to the content. And this is the same as when you use Google or Facebook services. You must agree to the terms in order to access the content. It's this model of online revenue that Ethan Zuckerman now regrets contributing to, a position he made clear in a 2014 piece in The Atlantic titled "The Internet's Original Sin," and I encourage you to read it from the link in the show notes. It's still incredibly relevant and almost prophetic now 5 years later. In my conversation with him, one of his key points had to do with the effectiveness of online advertising, and he offered this analogy.
If you count cards at blackjack, right? You don't magically win this ability to win every hand of blackjack. You're still going to lose many of your hands of blackjack. But what happens is that blackjack goes from a game where over time you're going to lose 51% of the time to a game where you're going to lose 49.5% of the time. And so that shift from, you know, 51% loss to 49.5% loss, if you're absolutely perfect at it, is what you get from adding that little bit of data, like that data of whether the deck is rich in face cards or not. I think that advertising sort of plays on the same dynamics. Right now, the odds that you're going to click on an ad on the web are basically zero. And what demographic targeting tries to do is make the odds slightly better than absolute zero. But because that inventory is otherwise worth zero, making it worth slightly more than absolute zero and then making a whole lot of inventory is potentially a profitable business model. Is it a good business model? No, absolutely not. It's not good for anyone involved with it. But it is this way of making a very modest amount of money off of the system. And, you know, the questions then become, what are the associated costs with it?
The cost for advertisers is clear. When Facebook went public in 2012, the company reported a quarterly revenue of around $1 billion. For the second quarter of 2019, that number was $16.9 billion. 16.4 of that was from advertising. The story is similar for Google. In 2001, ad revenue brought in $70 million. Last year, that number was $161 billion. So what's the cost to the rest of us who browse online? Well, it's your privacy. So what exactly is the dollar value of your data to these companies? This is where things get tricky. Because Google operates a gigantic ad network across the entire web, most anyone who has ever opened a browser and visited any website could be a potential audience for advertisers on the network. Certainly, Google uses data on individual users as well, but to get a better idea of what your data is worth, and this shouldn't come as a surprise, we look at Facebook. Just before its initial public offering in 2012, Facebook valued each of its users at $1.21 per quarter. This means that Facebook anticipated that for each user of its platform, it could obtain a little less than $5 a year from advertisers and other revenue sources. None of this money would come from the user directly. Fast forward to 2019, and Facebook reported that each of its users worldwide, on average, brought in $6.94, or about $28 annually. That's an increase of 575%. But if you live in the US and Canada, your data were worth even more to Facebook. Try $32.60 per quarter, over $120 a year. As an aside, should you see one of those chain messages going around again about Facebook ceasing to be free, you can see here Facebook doesn't need your money, they just need your data. So just disregard the message, or better yet, comment with a link to this podcast. Anyhow, this information isn't a secret. These numbers came from Facebook's second quarter 2019 results, which are available freely on its investor relations website. If you want to see for yourself, the link's in the show notes. It's rather remarkable to think that Facebook has taken a concept like targeted advertising and turned it into such a profitable business by continuing to offer its users a free service. Of course, many free-to-play games seem this way also, except the cost is straightforward each time you approve one of the microtransactions. The cost of using Facebook isn't so easily seen or understood. Sure, it's buried in the terms and conditions, but that's much harder to read and understand than a set amount of money leaving your bank account. While you're processing this, let's take a moment to reconsider one of the statements Professor Zuckerman made a moment ago.
Is it a good business model? No, no, absolutely not. It's not good for anyone involved with it.
This certainly makes sense when you consider that generally, online users are giving up privacy in order for Facebook to tell its advertisers it's able to slightly increase the chance that a given user will click on their ad. And this is what has ultimately resulted in low-quality, omnipresent advertising across the web. However, it turns out that on the local scale, targeted advertising may actually have its advantages, especially at the intersection of word-of-mouth, print, and online advertising.
We believe almost everything that our social groups support, right? Like I'm much more apt to buy a mascara if someone in my Facebook feed or my friend group is going to recommend it, right? If it's in my circle of social, then I'm much more apt to go make that purchase. And advertisers know that, and that's why that I just think social media is going to continue to grow and dominate. And the more that we can partner, right? Like we have a great, most newspaper organizations have had great partnerships with Google for many, many years because they needed our audience early on. And boy, do we ever need them now for data and analytics.
And Phyllis Weber sees the partnership with big data organizations as a great thing for the newspaper, especially when it comes to serving ads for local businesses on the paper's website. And local news is important. The presence of a journalist at a local town gathering or board meeting lowers the likelihood of bureaucratic corruption. And so, therefore, as I've discovered, we find ourselves at this strange point in history where print publications are now using the same or similar data collection techniques as large online advertisers. And so it's really hard to tell the difference between some of their terms and conditions agreements. So is it worth it? Is advertising really the internet's original sin? I'll leave that for you to decide, but let's take a moment to think about what we've discussed so far. Advertising has taken many forms over the years, from outdoor signs to street corner criers, all the way to radio and television, and then the pop-up ad and now targeted advertising. Think about the reach of each of these, though. The potential audience became larger and larger as technology progressed, but now advertisers have realized that a larger audience isn't necessarily better. Which brings us to our current system. Whenever you visit a website, you agree to give up certain details about yourself to a company in exchange for an online service. It all comes back to the terms and conditions agreements and privacy policies. These are the contracts you're agreeing to by using the services. But the word contract is inherently a legal term. So how did companies just decide on what to include in the agreements? And why have we ended up with agreements spanning thousands of words? Oh, and what happens when these agreements intersect with local and federal law? That's next time on Terms and Conditions Apply. Terms and Conditions Apply is written and produced by Ethan D. Smith. Special thanks to my guests for this episode. First, Phyllis Weber. If you'd like to learn more about the Roanoke Times and see Phyllis's work in action on its website, visit roanoke.com for more information. And if you happen to live in Southwest Virginia, consider advertising with the paper or purchasing a digital subscription. Special thanks also to Professor Ethan Zuckerman. If you'd like to learn more about Professor Zuckerman's research at the MIT Media Lab, visit the link in the show notes to read about his most recent projects, including ones that examine how high-profile trends on social media impact our lives in the physical world. The theme music for this podcast is composed by Lee Rosevere, and other music you heard is composed by Kevin McLeod. The tracks are used under Creative Commons 4.0 and 3.0 licenses, respectively. The end credit theme you hear now is performed by Josh Lippi and the Overtimers. You can find links to more from all three artists in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends. If you want to learn more about the topics covered in this episode, check out the links in the show notes or open a browser and start your own research. There's way too much information to cover in just a few episodes of a podcast, and the online privacy landscape is constantly changing, so I encourage you to get out there and see for yourself.